I couldn't believe it. I told him I wanted out. So he drove me down to some awful place. His son was there. He had two Hispanic guys there with him. There was this other guy chained up in a back room. Kleiner said this was a guy who had stepped out of line. He told me to watch carefully. His son just kicked the guy to a pulp all over the room, right in front of me. Then the Hispanic guys got their knives out and just hacked the poor guy apart. There was blood everywhere. It was horrible. I couldn't believe it. I threw up all over the place. Go on, I said. It was a nightmare, Hubble said. I couldn't sleep that night. I thought I'd never sleep again, any night. Friday morning we flew home. We sat together on the little jet, and he told me what would happen. He said it wouldn't be just me who got cut up. It would be Charlie, too. He was discussing it with me. Which of her nipples would he slice off first? Left or right? Then after we were dead, which of the children would he start with? Lucy or Ben? It was a nightmare. He said they'd nail me to the wall. I was shitting myself. Then we landed, and he called Charlie and insisted we go to dinner with him. He told her we were doing business together. Charlie was delighted because Kleiner is such a big deal in the county. It was a total nightmare because I had to pretend there was nothing wrong. I hadn't even told Charlie I'd lost my job. I had to pretend I was still at the bank. And the whole evening that bastard was asking politely after Charlie and the children and smiling at me. We went quiet. I skirted around the southeast corner of Atlanta again, looking for the highway south. The big city glowed and glittered on the right. To the left was the dark, empty mass of the rural southeast. I found the highway and accelerated south, down toward one little dot in that dark, empty mass. Then what? I asked him. I started work at the warehouse, he said. That's where he wanted me. Doing what? I said. Managing the supply, he said. I had a little office in there, and I had to arrange to get the dollars, and then I'd supervise the loading and shipping. Sherman Stoller was the driver? I asked him. Right, he said. He was trusted to do the Florida run. I'd send him out with $1 million bills a week. Sometimes the gate men did it if Sherman had a day off, but it was usually him. He helped me with the boxes and the loading. We had to work like crazy. $1 million in singles is a hell of a sight. You've got no idea. It was like trying to empty a swimming pool with a shovel. But Sherman was stealing, right? I said. He nodded. I saw the flash of his steel glasses and the glow from the dash. The money got counted properly in Venezuela, he said. I used to get accurate totals back after about a month or so. I used them to cross-check my weighing formula. Many times we were about $100,000 down. No way had I made that kind of mistake. It was a trivial amount, because we were generating $4 billion in excellent fakes at the other end, so who cared? But it was about a box full every time. That would be a large margin of error, so I figured Sherman was stealing the occasional box. And, I said, I warned him off, Hubble said. I mean, I wasn't going to tell anybody about it. I just told him to take care because Kleiner would kill him if he found out. Might get me into trouble as well. I was already worried enough about what I was doing. The whole thing was insane. Kleiner was importing a lot of the fakes. He couldn't resist it. I thought it made the whole thing way too visible. Teal was spending the fakes like confetti, prettying up the town. "And what about the last 12 months?" I asked him. He shrugged and shook his head. "We had to stop the shipping," he said. "The Coast Guard thing made it impossible. Kleiner decided to stockpile instead. He figured the interdiction couldn't last. He knew the Coast Guard budget wouldn't stand it for long, but it just lasted and lasted. It was a hell of a year. The tension was awful. And now the Coast Guard's finally pulling back. It's caught us by surprise. Kleiner figured it's lasted this long, it would last until after the election in November. We're not ready to ship. Not ready at all. It's all just piled up in there. It's not boxed yet." "When did you contact Joe?" I asked him. "Joe?" he said. "Was that your brother's name?" I knew him as Polo. I nodded. "Polo," I said. "It's where he was born. It's a town on Leyte, Philippine Islands. The hospital was converted from an old cathedral. I had malaria shots there when I was 7. He went quiet for a while, like he was paying his respects. "I called Treasury a year ago," he said. "I didn't know who else to call. Couldn't call the police because of Morrison. Couldn't call the FBI because of Picard. So I called Washington and tipped off this guy who called himself Polo. He was a smart guy. I thought he'd get away with it. I knew his best chance was to strike while they were stockpiling, while there was evidence in there. I saw a sign for gas and took a last-minute decision to pull off. Hubble filled the tank. I found a plastic bottle in a trash can and got him to fill that, too." "What's that for?" he asked me. I shrugged at him. "Emergencies?" I said. He didn't come back on that. We just paid at the window and pulled back onto the highway, carried on driving south. We were a half hour from Margrave. It was approaching midnight. "So what made you take off on Monday?" I asked him. "Kleiner called me," he said. "He told me to stay home. He said two guys would be coming by. I asked him why, and he said there was a problem at the Florida end, and I had to go sort it out." "But," I said. "I didn't believe him," he said. "Soon as he mentioned two guys, it flashed into my mind what had happened down in Jacksonville that first week. I panicked. I called the taxi and ran." "You did good, Hubble," I said. "You saved your life." "You know what?" he said. I glanced a question at him. "If he had said one guy, I wouldn't have noticed," he said. "You know, if he had said, 'Stay home, a guy's coming by,' I'd have fallen for it. But he said two guys." "He made a mistake," I said. "I know," Hubble said. "I can't believe it. He never makes mistakes." I shook my head, smiled in the dark. "He made a mistake last Thursday." The big chrome clock on the Bentley's dash said midnight. I needed this whole deal over and done by 5 in the morning. So I had 5 hours. If all went well, that was way more than I needed. If I screwed up, it didn't matter if I had 5 hours or 5 days or 5 years. This was a once-only thing, in and out. In the service, we used to say, "Do it once and do it right." Tonight I was going to add, "And do it quickly." "Hubble," I said, "I need your help." He roused himself and looked over at me. "Huh?" he asked. I spent the last 10 minutes of the highway cruise going over it, over and over it, until he was totally solid. I swung off the highway where it met the county road, blasted past the warehouses, and on down the 14 miles to town, slowed as I passed the station house. It was quiet, lights off, no cars in the lot. The firehouse next door looked okay. The town was silent and deserted. The only light showing in the whole place was in the barber shop. I made the right onto Beckman and drove up the rise to Hubble's place, turned in at the familiar white mailbox, and spun the wheel through the curves up the driveway, pulled up at the door. "My car keys are in the house," Hubble said. "It's open," I said. He went to check it out, pushed at the splintered door gingerly with one finger, like it might be booby-trapped. I saw him go in. A minute later, he was back out. He had his keys, but he didn't walk round to the garage. He came back over to me and leaned into the car. "It's a hell of a mess in there," he said. "What's been going on?" "I used this place for an ambush," I said. "Four guys were tramping all over the place looking for me. It was raining at the time." He leaned down and looked in at me. "Were they the ones?" he said. "You know, the ones Kleiner would have sent, if I had talked?" I nodded. "They had all the gear with them," I said. I could see his face in the dim glow from the old dials on the dash. His eyes were wide open, but he wasn't seeing me. He was seeing what he'd seen in his nightmares. He nodded slowly. Then he reached in and put his hand on my arm. Squeezed it. Didn't speak. Then he ducked back out and was gone. I was left sitting there, wondering how the hell I'd ever hated the guy a week ago. I used the time to reload the Desert Eagle. I replaced the four shells I'd used out there on the highway near Augusta. Then I saw Hubble drive his old green Bentley around from the garage. The engine was cold, and he was trailing a cloud of white vapor. He gave me a thumbs up as he passed, and I followed the white cloud down the driveway and down Beckman. We passed by the church and turned left onto Main Street in stately procession. Two fine old cars, nose to tail through the sleeping town, ready to do battle. Hubble pulled up 40 yards shy of the station house, pulled into the curb just where I had told him to, killed his lights and waited, motor running. I wafted past him and nosed into the police department lot, parked up in the end slot and got out, left all four doors unlocked, pulled the big automatic out of my pocket. The night air was cold and the silence was crushing. I could hear Hubble's motor idling from 40 yards away. I unlatched the Desert Eagle's safety, and the click sounded deafening in the stillness. I ran to the station house wall and dropped to the ground, slid forward until I could see in through the bottom of the heavy glass door, watched and listened, held my breath. I watched and listened long enough to be sure. I stood up and clicked the safety back on, put the gun back in my pocket, stood there and made a calculation. The firehouse and the station house stood together 300 yards from the north end of Main Street. Further on up the road, Eno's was 800 yards away. I figured the earliest anybody could get to us would be maybe 3 minutes. 2 minutes to react, and a minute for a fast jog up from Main Street. So we had 3 minutes. Have that for a margin of safety. Call it 90 seconds, beginning to end. I ran out to the middle of the county road and waved a signal to Hubble. I saw his car pull away from the curb, and I ran over to the firehouse entrance, stood to the side of the big red door, and waited. Hubble drove up and slewed his old Bentley in a tight turn across the road, ended up at a right angle, just about lined up with the firehouse entrance, facing away from me. I saw the car lurch as he slammed the shift into reverse. Then he hit the gas, and the big old sedan shot backward toward me. It accelerated all the way and smashed backward into the firehouse door. That old Bentley must have weighed 2 tons, and it tore the metal door right off its mountings with no trouble at all. There was a tremendous crashing and tearing of metal, and I heard the rear lights smash and the clang of the fender as it fell off and bounced on the concrete. I was through the gap between the door and the frame before Hubble slammed into drive and dragged clear of the wreckage. It was dark in there, but I found what I was looking for. It was clipped to the side of the fire truck, horizontally, at head height. A bolt cutter. A huge thing, must have been 4 feet long. I wrenched it out of its mountings and ran for the door. Soon as Hubble saw me come out, he pulled a wide circle across the road. The back end of his Bentley was wrecked. The trunk lid was flapping and the sheet metal was crunched and screeching. But he did his job. He made the wide turn and lined up with the station house entrance, paused for a second, and floored the gas, accelerated straight toward the heavy glass doors, this time head-on. The old Bentley smashed through the doors in a shower of glass and demolished the reception desk, plowed on into the squad room, and stopped. I ran in right behind it. Finley was standing in the middle cell, frozen in shock. He was handcuffed by his left wrist to the bars separating him from the end cell. Well to the back. Couldn't have been better. I tore and shoved at the wreckage of the reception counter and cleared a path behind Hubble, waved him back. He spun the wheel and reversed into the space I had cleared. I hauled and shoved the squad room desks out of the way to give him a clear run in front, turned, and gave him the signal. The front end of his car was as bad as the back. The hood was buckled and the radiator was smashed. Green water was pouring out of the bottom, and steam was hissing out of the top. The headlights were smashed and the fender was rubbing the tire. But Hubble was doing his job. He was holding the car on the brake and speeding the motor, just like I had told him to. I could see the car shuddering against the brake. Then it shot forward and hurtled toward Finlay in the middle cell, smashed into the titanium bars at an angle, and ripped them open like a swung axe on a picket fence. The Bentley's hood flew up and the windshield exploded. Torn metal clanged and screeched. Hubble came to a stop, a yard short of where Finlay was standing. The wrecked car settled in a loud hiss of steam. The air was thick with dust. I dived through the gap into the cell and clamped the bolt cutter on the link, fixing Finlay's wrist to the bars. Leaned on the 4-foot levers until the handcuffs sheared through. I gave Finlay the bolt cutter and hauled him through the gap and out of the cell. Hubble was climbing out of the Bentley's window. The impact had distorted the door, and it wouldn't open. I pulled him out and leaned in and yanked the keys. Then we all three ran through the shattered squad room and crunched over the shards of plate glass where the big doors had been. Ran over to the car and dove in. I started it up and howled backward out of the lot, slammed into drive, and took off down the road toward town. Finlay was out. 90 seconds, beginning to end. 32. I slowed down at the north end of Main Street and rolled gently south through the sleeping town. Nobody spoke. Hubble was lying on the rear bench, shaken up. Finlay was beside me in the front passenger seat, just sitting there, rigid, staring out through the windshield. We were all breathing heavily. We were all in that quiet zone which follows an intense blast of danger. The clock on the dash showed 1 in the morning. I wanted to hold up until 4. I had a superstitious thing about 4 o'clock in the morning. We used to call it KGB time. Story was, it was the time they chose to go knocking on doors. 4 o'clock in the morning. Story was, it had always worked well for them. Their victims were at a low ebb at that hour. Progress was easy. We had tried it ourselves time to time. It had always worked well for me, so I wanted to wait until 4, one last time. I jinked the car left and right, down the service alleys, behind the last block of stores, switched the running lights off, and pulled up in the dark behind the barber shop, killed the motor. Finley glanced around and shrugged. Going to the barber at 1 in the morning was no more crazy than driving a $100,000 Bentley into a building, no more crazy than getting locked in a cell for 10 hours by a madman. After 20 years in Boston and 6 months in Margrave, there wasn't a whole lot left that Finley was ever going to raise an eyebrow at. Hubble leaned forward from the back seat. He was pretty shaken up. He had deliberately driven into 3 separate crashes. The 3 impacts had left him battered and jarred, and drained. It had taken a lot to keep his foot jammed down on the gas, heading for one solid object after another. But he'd done it. Not everybody would have. But he was suffering for it now. I slid out of the seat and stood in the alley, gestured Hubble out of the car. He joined me in the dark, stood there, a bit unsteady. "You okay?" I asked him. He shrugged. "I guess," he said. "I banged my knee and my neck hurts like hell." "Walk up and down," I said. "Don't stiffen up." I walked him up and down the dark alley, 10 paces up and back a couple of times. He was pecking his stride on the left. Maybe the door had caved in and hit his left knee. He was rolling his head around, loosening the jarred muscles in his neck. "Okay," I said. He smiled, changed it to a grimace as a tendon graunched. "I'll live," he said. Finley got out and joined us in the alley. He was coming round. He was stretching like he was waking up, getting excited. He smiled at me in the dark. "Good job, Reacher," he said. "I was wondering how the hell you were going to get me out. What happened to Picard?" I made a gun with my fingers, like a child's mime. He nodded a sort of partner's nod to me, too reserved to go any further. I shook his hand. Seemed like the right thing to do. Then I turned and rapped softly on the service door at the back of the barber shop. It opened up straight away. The older guy was standing there like he'd been waiting for us to knock. He held the door like some kind of an old butler, gestured us in. We trooped single file down a passage into a storeroom, waited next to shelves piled high with barber stuff. The gnarled old man caught up to us. "We need your help," I said. The old guy shrugged, held up his mahogany palm in a wait gesture, shuffled through to the front, and came back with his partner, the younger old guy. They discussed my request in loud, rasping whispers.
"Upstairs,"
the younger guy said. We filed up a narrow staircase, came out in an apartment above the shop. The 2 old barbers showed us through to the living room. They pulled the blinds and switched on a couple of dim lamps, waved us to sit. The room was small and threadbare, but clean. It had a cozy feel. I figured if I had a room, I'd want it to look like that. We sat down. The younger guy sat with us, and the older guy shuffled out again, closed the door. The 4 of us sat there looking at each other. Then the barber leaned forward. "You boys ain't the first to hide out with us," he said. Finley glanced around, appointed himself spokesman. "We're not?" he said. "No, sir, you're not," the barber said. "We've had lots of boys hiding out with us. And girls, too, tell the truth."
"Like who?" Finley asked.
"You name it, we had it," the old guy said. "We've had farm workers' union boys from the peanut farms. We've had farm workers' union boys from the peach growers. We've had civil rights girls from the voter registration. We've had boys who didn't want their ass sent to Vietnam. You name it, we had it."
Finley nodded.
"And now you've got us," he said. "Local trouble?" the barber asked. Finley nodded again.
"Big trouble," he said. "Big change is coming."
"Been expecting it," the old guy said.
"Been expecting it for years."
"You have?" Finley said.
The barber nodded and stood up, stepped over to a large closet, opened the door, and waved us over to take a look. It was a big closet, fitted with deep shelves. The shelves were stacked with money, bricks and bricks of cash held together with rubber bands. It filled the closet from floor to ceiling. Must have been a couple of $100,000 in there.
"Kleiner Foundation's money," the old guy said. "They just keep on throwing it at us. Something wrong with it. I'm 74 years old. 70 years, people are pissing all over me. Now people are throwing money all over me. Something wrong with that, right?"
He closed the door on the cash.
"We don't spend it," he said. "We don't spend a cent we don't earn. We just put it in the closet. You boys going after the Kleiner Foundation?"
"Tomorrow there won't be any Kleiner Foundation," I said.
The old guy just nodded, glanced at the closet door as he passed by, and shook his head, closed the door on us, and left us alone in the small, cozy room.
"Not going to be easy," Finley said. "Three of us and three of them. They hold four hostages. Two of the hostages are children. We're not even certain where they're holding them."
"They're at the warehouse," I said.
"That's for sure. Where else would they be? No manpower available to hold them anyplace else. And you heard that tape, that boomy echo? That was the warehouse, for sure."
"What's ape?"
Hubble asked. Finley looked at him.
"They had Roscoe make a tape for Reacher," he said. "A message, to prove they were holding her."
"Roscoe?" Hubble said. "What about Charlie?" Finley shook his head.
"Just Roscoe," he lied. "Nothing from Charlie."
Hubble nodded. "Smart move, Harvard guy," I thought. The image of Charlie being held down at a microphone with a sharp knife at her throat would have tipped Hubble right over the edge, right off the plateau, back down to where panic would make him useless.
"The warehouse is where they are," I said again. "No doubt about it."
Hubble knew the warehouse well. He'd been working up there most days for a year and a half, so we got him to go over and over it, describing the layout. We found paper and pencil and got him to draw plans. We went over and over the plans, putting in all the doors, the stairs, the distances, the details. We ended up with the sort of drawing an architect would have been proud of. The warehouse stood in its own compound at the end of the row of four. It was very close in line with the third shed, which was a farmer's operation. There was a fence running between the two, with just a path's width between it and the metal siding. The other three sides were ringed by the main fence running around the whole complex. That fence ran close to the warehouse across the back and down the far end, but there was plenty of space in front for trucks to turn. The big roller door covered just about the whole of the front wall. There was a small staff door just around the far corner which gave on to the main floor. There was a cage just inside the staff door where the roller door winch was sighted. Go in the staff door and turn left. There was an open metal staircase running up to an office. The office was cantilevered way up into the top back corner of the huge shed, hanging there about 40 feet above the main floor. The office had big windows and a railed balcony looking down into the shed for supervision. In back, the office had a door leading out to an external fire escape, which was another open metal staircase bolted to the outside back wall.
Okay, I said. Clear enough, right?
Finlay shrugged.
I'm worried about reinforcements, he said. Guards on the exterior.
I shrugged back. There won't be reinforcements, I said. I'm more worried about the shotguns. It's a big space, and there are two kids in there.
Finlay nodded, looked grim. He knew what I was saying.
Shotguns spray a cone of lead over a big, wide angle. Shotguns and children don't mix. We went quiet. It was nearly 2 in the morning, an hour and a half to wait. We would leave at 3:30, get up there at 4. My favorite attack time.
The waiting period, like soldiers in a dugout, like pilots before a raid. It was silent. Finlay dozed. He had done this before, probably many times. He sprawled in his chair. His left arm hung over the side. Half of the shattered handcuff dangled from his wrist, like a silver bracelet. Hubble sat upright. He hadn't done this before. He just fidgeted it around, burning energy. Couldn't blame him. He kept looking over at me, questions in his eyes. I just kept on shrugging back at him. 2:30, there was a knock on the door. Just a soft tap. The door opened a foot. The older of the two old barbers was there. He pointed a gnarled and trembling finger into the room, aimed straight at me.
"Someone to see you, son," he said.
Finlay sat up, and Hubble looked scared. I signaled them both to stay put, stood up, and pulled the big automatic out of my pocket. Clicked the safety off. The old guy flapped his hand at me and fussed.
"You don't need that, son," he said. "Don't need that at all."
He was impatient, beckoning me out to join him. I put the gun away again, shrugged at the other two, and went with the old guy. He led me into a tiny kitchen. There was a very old woman in there, sitting on a stool. Same mahogany color as the old guy, stick thin. She looked like an old tree in winter.
"This is my sister," the old barber said. "You boss woke her up, chattering."
Then he stepped over to her, bent down, and spoke right in her ear.
"This is the boy I told you about," he said.
She looked up and smiled at me. It was like the sun coming out. I caught a flash of the beauty she must have had long ago. She held out her hand, and I took it. Felt like thin wires in a soft, dry glove. The old barber left us alone together in the kitchen, stopped as he passed me.
"Ask her about him," he said.
The old guy shuffled out.
I still had the old lady's hand in mine. I squatted down next to her. She didn't try to pull her hand away, just left it nestled there, like a brown twig in my huge paw.
"I don't hear so good," she said. "You got to lean close."
I spoke in her ear. She smelled like an old flower, like a faded bloom. "How's this?" I said.
"That's good, son," she said. "I can hear that okay."
"I was asking your brother about Blind Blake," I said.
"I don't ask, son," she said. "He told me all about it."
"He told me you knew him," I said in her ear.
"I sure did," she said. "I knew him real well."
"Will you tell me about him?" I asked her. She turned her head and gazed at me sadly.
"What's the tale?" she said. "He's been gone a real long time."
"What was he like?" I said. She was still gazing at me. Her eyes were misting over as she trolled backward 60, 70 years.
"He was blind," she said.
She didn't say anything more for a while. Her lips fluttered soundlessly, and I could feel a strong pulse hammering in her bony wrist. She moved her head as if she was trying to hear something from far away.
"He was blind," she said again. "And he was a sweet boy."
She was more than 90 years old. She was as old as the 20th century, so she was remembering back to her 20s and 30s. Not to her childhood or her teens. She was remembering back to her womanhood, and she was calling Blake a sweet boy.
"I was a singer," she said, "and he played the guitar. You know that old expression? He could play the guitar just like ringing a bell. That's what I used to say about Blake. He would pick up that old instrument of his, and the notes would just come tumbling out faster than you could sing them. But each note was just a perfect little silver bell floating off into the air. We'd sing and play all night long. Then in the morning I'd lead him out into a meadow and we'd sit under some old shade tree and we'd sing and play some more. Just for the joy of it. Just because I could sing and he could play."
She hummed a couple of bars of something under her breath. Her voice was about a fifth lower pitched than it ought to have been. She was so thin and fragile you'd have expected a high, faltering soprano, but she was singing with a low, breathy contralto. I thought back with her and put the two of them in an old Georgia meadow, the heavy smell of wildflower blossom, the buzz of lazy noontime insects, the two of them, backs against a tree, singing and playing for the joy of it, belting out the wry, defiant songs that Blake had made up and that I loved so much. "What happened to him?" I asked her. "Do you know?" She nodded.
"Two people on this earth know that," she whispered. "I'm one of them."
"Will you tell me?" I said. "I sort of came down here to find out."
62 years, she said. "I never told a soul in 62 years.
Will you tell me? I asked her again.
She nodded, sadly, tears in her misty old eyes.
62 years, she said. You're the first person ever asked me.
I held my breath. Her lips fluttered, and her hands scrabbled in my palm.
He was blind, she said, but he was sporty. You know that word? Sporty? It means kind of uppity. Uppity with a smile and a grin is sporty. Blake was sporty. Had a lot of spirit and energy. Walked fast and talked fast, always moving, always smiling his sweet fool head off. But one time, we came out of a place in town here, walking down the sidewalk, laughing. Nobody else around but for two white folks coming toward us on the sidewalk, a man and a boy. I saw them and ducked off the sidewalk like we were supposed to, stood in the dirt to let them pass. But poor Blake was blind, didn't see them, just crashed into the white boy. A white boy, maybe 10 years old, maybe 12. Blake sent him flying into the dirt. White boy cut his head on a stone, set up such a hollering like you never heard. The white boy's daddy was there with him. I knew him. He was a big, important man in this town. His boy was screaming, fit to burst, screaming at his daddy to punish the nigger. So the daddy lost his temper and set about Blake with his cane, big silver knob on the top. He beat poor Blake with that cane until his head was just split open like a burst watermelon. Killed him stone dead. Picked up the boy and turned to me. Sent me over to the horse trough to wash poor Blake's hair and blood and brains off from the end of his cane. Told me never to say a word about it or he'd kill me too. So I just hid out and waited until somebody else found poor Blake down the sidewalk. Then I ran out screaming and hollering with the rest of them all. Never said a word about it to another living soul that day to this.
Big wet tears were welling out of her eyes and rolling slowly down her thin cheeks. I reached over and smudged them dry with the back of my finger, took her other hand in mine.
Who was the boy? I asked her.
Somebody I seen around ever since, she said. Somebody I seen sneering around just about every day since, reminding me of my poor Blake lying there with his head split open.
Who was he? I said.
It was an accident, she said. Anybody could have seen that. Poor Blake was a blind man. Boy didn't have to set up such a hollering. He wasn't hurt so bad. He was old enough to know better. It was his fault for hollering and screaming like he did.
Who was the boy? I asked her again. She turned to me and stared into my eyes, told me the 62-year-old secret.
Grover Teal, she said.
Grew up to be mayor, just like his old daddy.
thinks he's king of the damn world. But he's just a screaming brat who got my poor Blake killed for no reason at all, except he was blind and he was black.
33. We piled back into Charlie's black Bentley in the alley behind the barber shop. Nobody spoke. I fired it up, swung out and rolled north, kept the lights off and drove slow. The big dark sedan rolled north through the night like a stealthy animal leaving its lair, like a big black submarine slipping its mooring and gliding out into icy water. I drove through the town and pulled up shy of the station house, quiet as a tomb. "I want to get a weapon," Finley said. We picked our way through the shattered wreckage of the entrance. Hubble's own Bentley was sitting in the squad room, inert in the gloom. The front tires had blown, and it had settled nose down, buried in the wreckage of the cells. There was a stink of gasoline. The tank must have split. The trunk lid was up because of the way the rear end was smashed in. Hubble didn't even glance at it. Finley picked his way past the wrecked car to the big office and back, disappeared inside. I waited with Hubble in the heap of shards that had been the entrance doors. Finley came back out of the dark with a stainless steel revolver and a book of matches, and a grin. He waved the two of us out to the car and struck a match, threw it under the rear of the wrecked green Bentley and crunched on out to join us.
"Diversion, right?" he said.
We saw the fires start as we nosed out of the lot. Bright blue flames were rolling across the carpet like a wave on the beach. The fire took hold of the splintered wood and rolled outward, feeding itself on the huge gasoline stain. The flames changed to yellow and orange, and the air started sucking in through the hole where the entrance had been. Within a minute, the whole place was burning. I smiled and took off up the county road. I used headlights for most of the 14 miles, drove fast, took maybe 12 minutes, doused the lights and pulled up a quarter mile short of the target, turned around in the road and backed up a little way, left the car facing south, down toward town, doors unlocked, keys in. Hubble carried the big bolt cutter. Finley checked the revolver he had taken from the office. I reached under the seat and pulled out the plastic bottle we had filled with gas, slipped it into my pocket with the sap. It was heavy. Pulled my jacket down on the right and brought the Desert Eagle up high on my chest. Finley gave me the matches. I put them in the other pocket. We stood together in the dark, in the dirt on the side of the road, exchanged tight nods, struck out over the field to the blasted tree. It was silhouetted against the moon. Took us a couple of minutes to get there. We slogged over the soft earth, paused against the distorted tree trunk. I took the bolt cutter from Hubble, and we nodded again and headed for the fence where it ran close to the back of the warehouse. It was 10 to 4 in the morning. Nobody had spoken since leaving the burning police building. It was 75 yards from the tree to the fence. Took us a minute. We kept on going until we were opposite the bottom of the fire escape, right where it was bolted down to the concrete path which ran around the whole building. Finlay and Hubble grabbed the chain link to put some tension on it, and I bit through each strand in turn with the bolt cutter. Went through it like it was licorice. I cut a big piece out, 7 feet high, right up to where the razor wire started, maybe 8 feet wide. We stepped through the gap, walked over to the bottom of the stairs, waited. I could hear sounds inside, movement and scraping. muffled to a dull boom by the huge space. I took a deep breath, motioned the others to flatten themselves against the metal siding. I still wasn't sure about exterior guards. My gut said there wouldn't be any reinforcements, but Finley was worried about it. And I had learned a long time ago to take account of what people like Finley worried about. So I motioned the others to stay put, and I crept around to the corner of the massive building, crouched down, and dropped the bolt cutter onto the concrete path from a height of about a foot. It made just about the right amount of noise. It sounded like somebody trying to break into the compound. I flattened myself against the wall and waited with the sap in my right hand. Finley was right. There was an exterior guard. And I was right. There were no reinforcements. The exterior guard was Sergeant Baker. He was on duty, patrolling outside the shed. I heard him before I saw him. I heard his tense breathing and his feet on the concrete. He came around the corner of the building and stopped a yard away from me. He stood and stared at the bolt cutter. He had his .38 in his hand. He looked at the bolt cutter and then swung his gaze along the fence as far as the missing panel. Then he started to run toward it. Then he died. I swung the sap and hit him, but he didn't go down. He dropped his revolver, danced a circle on rubber legs. Finley came up behind me, caught him by the throat. Looked like a country boy wringing a chicken's neck. Made a fine job of it. Baker was still wearing his acetate nameplate above his uniform pocket. First thing I had noticed, 9 days ago. We left his body on the path, waited 5 minutes, listened hard. Nobody else came. We went back to where Hubble was waiting. I took another deep breath, stepped onto the fire escape, went up, planted each foot carefully and silently on each step, eased my way up. The staircase was cast from some kind of iron or steel, open treads. The whole thing would ring like a damn bell if we were clumsy. Finley was behind me, gripping the handrail with his right hand, gun in his left. Behind him came Hubble, too scared to breathe. We crept up. Took us minutes to do the 40 feet. We were very cautious. We stood on the little platform at the top. I pressed my ear to the door. Quiet, no sound. Hubble pulled out his office keys, clenched in his hand to stop them jingling. He selected the right one, slowly, carefully, inched it into the lock. We held our breath. He turned the key. The lock clicked back, the door sagged open. We held our breath. No sound. No reaction. Quiet. Hubble eased the door back, slowly, carefully. Finley took it from him and eased it further, passed it to me. I eased it back flat against the wall, propped it all the way open with the bottle of gasoline from my pocket. Light was flooding out of the office, spilling over the fire escape and laying a bright bar down on the fence and the field 40 feet below. Arc lamps were lit inside the body of the warehouse, and they were flooding in through the big office windows. I could see everything in the office, and what I saw made my heart stop. I had never believed in luck, never had any cause to, never relied on it because I never could. But now I was lucky, in a big way. 36 years of bad luck and trouble were wiped away in one single bright glance. The gods were sitting on my shoulder, whooping and driving me on. In that one single bright glance, I knew that I had won. Because the children were asleep on the office floor. Hubble's kids, Ben and Lucy, sprawled out on a pile of empty burlap sacks, fast asleep, wide open and innocent, like only sleeping children can be. They were filthy and ragged, still dressed in their school clothes from Monday. They looked like ragamuffins in a sepia picture of old New York, sprawled out fast asleep, 4 o'clock in the morning. My lucky time. The children had been worrying the hell out of me. They were what made this whole damn thing just about impossible. I had thought it through 1,000 times. I'd run war games through my head, trying to find one that would work. I hadn't found one. I'd always come up with some kind of a bad outcome. What the staff colleges call unsatisfactory results. I'd always come up with the children splattered all over the place by the big shotguns. Children and shotguns don't mix. And I had always visualized the 4 hostages and the 2 shotguns in the same place at the same time. I had visualized panicking children and Charlie screaming and the big Ithacas booming, all in the same place. I hadn't come up with any kind of a solution. If I could have given anything I ever had, or ever would have, I'd have given it to have the children fast asleep somewhere else on their own. And it had happened. It had happened. The elation roared in my ears like a hysterical crowd in a huge stadium. I turned to the other 2, cupped a hand behind each of their heads and pulled them close to mine, spoke in the faintest of whispers.
"Hubble, take the girl," I whispered. "Finley, take the boy. Put a hand over their mouths. No sound at all. Carry them back to the tree. Hubble, take them on back to the car. Stay there with them and wait. Finley, come back here. Do it now. Do it quietly."
I pulled out the Desert Eagle and clicked the safety off, clamped my wrist against the door frame, and aimed across the office at the inner door. Finley and Hubble crept into the office. They did it right. They kept low. They kept quiet. They clamped their palms over the little mouths, scooped the children up, crept back out, straightened up and looped past the barrel of my big .44. The children woke up and struggled. Their wide eyes stared at me. Hubble and Finley carried them to the top of the long staircase, eased their way quietly down. I backed out of the doorway to the far corner of the metal platform, found an angle to cover them all the way, watched them pick their way slowly down the fire escape to the ground, to the fence, through the gap and away. They stepped through the bright bar of light spilling over the field 40 feet below me, and vanished into the night. I relaxed, lowered the gun, listened hard, heard nothing but the faint noises scraping up from inside the huge metal shed. I crept into the office, crawled over the floor to the windows, slowly raised my head up and looked out and down, saw a sight I would never, ever forget. There were 100 arc lights bolted up inside the roof of the warehouse. They lit the place up brighter than day. It was a big space. Must have been 100 feet long, maybe 80 deep, maybe 60 feet high. And it was full of dollar bills. A gigantic dune of money filled the whole shed. It was piled maybe 50 feet high into the back far corner. It sloped down to the floor like a mountainside. It was a mountain of cash. It reared up like a gigantic green iceberg. It was huge. I saw Teal at the far end of the shed. He was sitting on the lower slope of the mountain, maybe 10 feet up, shotgun across his knees. He was dwarfed by the huge green pile rearing above him. 50 feet closer to me, I saw old man Kleiner sitting higher up on the slope, sitting on 40 tons of money, shotgun across.